This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Shantideva's Guide to a Bodhisattva Way of Life. Those who wish to make progress in mind training should be very attentive in guarding their minds. For if they do not practice guarding the mind, they will not be able to realize the training. A crazy, untamed elephant in this world cannot inflict such harm as the sufferings of the deepest hell caused by the rampaging elephant of the mind. But if the elephant of our mind is held skillfully by the rope of mindfulness, fears will fall away and virtues will fall into our hands. This is from the chapter on guarding the mind or guarding introspection. And I thought beginning of this session would be a good place to start. Mind training. You know, in the teaching that, in a sense, encapsulates Buddhism, to cease from all harm, to do all that's good, and to study, train, realize the mind, we should examine the relationship between ceasing from harm and doing good and training and realizing the mind. Why don't we just cease from harm and do good and be done with it? Evidently, it's not so easy. But what is the relationship between mind and ceasing from harm, mind and actualizing good? Buddha realized there's no relationship at all. It's one and the same. And so to embark on the great path of enlightenment and to understand that we have to essentially, critically, unequivocally get our house in order, attend to our thoughts and our words and our actions, their consequences, may not seem evident in the beginning. Why not just be enlightened and be done with it? Or why not just get enlightened and then clean up our house? Won't that be much more enjoyable to clean it up once we're enlightened? The Buddha said it is not like this. And so from the beginning, mind is Buddha. That's it. Mind is Buddha. Buddha mind is clear and radiant, luminous, reaching everywhere. It's also pliant, flexible. It's resilient, it's stable, it's calm. That's our original mind. That's our natural mind. That's our ordinary mind. But there are winds blowing, and those winds blow all around us, and the dust is raised. They blow all through us, and the dust is raised. And so the mind becomes like an untamed, crazy elephant. So Shantideva was using an example that the students at his time would understand. It's like, oh yeah, crazy untamed elephant, don't get in the way of that one. And so what would our example be? I don't know, Times Square at rush hour. Presidential campaign. Just trying to get along. But the image of the elephant is important because it's the greatest of all animals. It's both very intelligent and very dangerous. It's powerful, it's hard to subdue, strong-willed. The elephant of our mind. And so he says it needs to be held skillfully by the rope of mindfulness. Simple words that, as we all know, sitting here in Sesshin, are not so simple to apply, to master, such that fears fall away and virtues will fall into our hands. And so, in a sense, from the beginning, mind is Buddha, no practice is necessary. And at the same time, all of practice is learning how to practice. In a very real sense, all of practice is learning how to practice. And at every point along the way, if there is sincere effort and hearing the teachings and reflecting them on them and putting them into practice, making them practice, then even though all along the way we're learning to practice, all along the way we're practicing. It's not learning to do something, finally having learned it, and now doing something. It's doing it all along the way. And all along the way, we're learning more and more how to do it. And it's a different kind of learning, isn't it? There is the understanding this part of it, understanding the teachings and applying them. And that's quite important. But there is another kind of learning that isn't like that. Shanti Davis says, it's not possible to subdue unruly beings, both inner and outer, who are as extensive as space. Right? They're everywhere. How could we subdue them? There's no way to be everywhere at once. There's too many. Each of them has their own mind, their own unruliness. And he says, but bringing peace to the mind is the same as subduing all of these beings. Bringing peace to the mind of greed, of anger, of impatience, of irritation, of envy, pride. Being peace is the same as overcoming all of those many beings. And the thing is when we can meet and skillfully bring peace to the many beings in the mind, then miraculously, the beings all around us are subdued within their unruliness. They're still raising hell. But there is a subduing of those many outer beings when the beings within our mind are subdued. How is that? And what he's pointing to is that, you know, when we try to control our world, and dukkha essentially is talking about a continual attempt to find what we naturally seek, peace, serenity, contentment, satisfaction, happiness, joy. That when we try to achieve that by controlling those many unruly beings who are getting in our way, who are messing up our party, and their situations and their circumstances and what they're doing to us, this is a reasonably hopeless task. Right? Because that controlling, you can never let it up. Right? Can never let it up. It's like when the monster is trying to get in your room and you're leaning all your weight against the door to keep that monster out. That's it. There's no leaving that door. There's no not leaning into it. The moment we let up, monster's in. So what Shanti Deva is saying is, go ahead. Let it in. The control has no end, except to grow. Because the more unruly, the more force is needed. And this is our aggression, our expectations, our agendas. And so too when we try to stop the mind. So we see that there's a relationship between our distractedness, our lack of mindfulness, and our insight, and our peace, and our well-being. We see that there's a direct relationship. And if we haven't seen that yet, then we're just not yet paying close attention. But seeing that, then how do we not just naturally not do what we have always done? Control that monster. Put that agitated mind into a box. Stop it. Same thing. When we try to exert force on the mind that is not skillful, we can subdue it in degrees and in certain ways, but the moment we relax it, I mean, this is what I saw in my practice in the early years. Right? Doing what I had knew how to do, right? Lean on that thing. Sit on it. And I would find exactly that, that there were ways in which I developed concentration and dropped down into deeper states, and that the moment that I relaxed that, and I thought, well, just lean some more. Keep leaning. Or maybe the point is just never let up. Or maybe something else is needed. Bringing peace to the mind of fear and anger is peace, is being peace. You know, to really think about how the path of wisdom is actually being wise. The path of compassion is being compassionate. You know, we're so groomed, indoctrinated in path to a goal. You know, it's like making a meal. You have all these ingredients. You're putting them all together. But you can't eat until it's all finished. And that's why we have to really break free of that kind of thinking. Because how else to have faith enough faith in a new way, in a way that will seem wrong, as in not applying that force or not being harsh, not being critical, when being critical clearly seems needed, because what we're seeing is clearly not good or right or enough. How else to break that cycle? As long as we believe that no matter what I do now, we're going somewhere good. Right? I can persevere. I can tolerate hell as long as I know heaven's coming. And it's a testimony to our endurance as to how long each of us can practice by that promise, that self-made promise. Usually it has to start coming apart. Usually we have to get to the point where that is, we're not just seeing it, oh, now I see, that's not working. Okay, I'll just shift. Now, I don't think it usually works like that. Usually it's things are coming apart. And the thing, well, you know who the thing is. In other words, we've taken it to the limit in a certain sense, and the limit is pushing back. And it's saying, uh-uh. You cannot take this by force. Just like Monk Ming, who came to get the transmission rope from Hweka, right, upset that he had been received the transmission, to take that back. Hweka puts it down on the stone and said, this was given to me in faith. It can't be taken by force. And because of that, because it can't be taken by force, I leave it here for you to do with what you will. And at that moment, that all of that whole life of being a certain way, responding in a certain way, that had brought him to that moment, collapsed. Shanti Deva says, where is there enough leather to cover the surface of the earth to protect your feet? But if you just have enough leather, if you have leather on the soles of your feet, this is the same as covering the entire earth. Training the mind. Understanding the nature of things from the center of the nature of things. So this is trying to control us like that, to create a barrier between ourselves and whatever offends us, this image of covering the ground with leather so that our feet aren't hurt. Covering the whole earth with leather. And so we all have our ways of doing this by avoiding all of the thorns of our lives, trying to get everybody to love us, avoiding conflicts, hiding our anger, be self-deprecating, or we might go another way. We might be angry first, overpower anger with more anger. We might push back, intimidate others, keep them at a distance. Or we might just try and avoid the thing altogether. Don't leave home in any number of ways. Don't get into new situations. And so when we talk about training as mutual polishing, like rough stones that are thrown into a tumbler and just tumble against each other. And just naturally, they're not going after each other. They're just tumbling. They're just moving in accord with each day. And in the process, they just naturally bump up against each other. And those rough edges begin to smooth down. Of course, the rougher they are, the harder the stone, It could take a while. Shanti Deva says, just as I would be careful of a wound when in a jostling and unruly crowd, so should I also guard the wound of my mind when among those who might provoke delusions. It's like how to convey that sense of the kind of meticulous effort, the kind of careful attention that is needed, right, in a way that anybody could understand. So you've got a wound, right, on your arm, and you're going through a jostling and unruly crowd, and everybody's bumping up against it, and it hurts. And so within that, the turbulence of that crowd, we move really carefully, guarding that wound. We don't want anybody to bump into it. So should I always guard the wound of my mind when among those who might provoke delusions? And that, you know, that wound won't be ignored. Every time somebody bumps it, we're reminded. We're reminded. We're reminded. And so it keeps us alert. And that's the another aspect of dukkha. Dukkha as a motivator. Dukkha as an ally. Dukkha as that which won't let us go to sleep. And the wound is easy because it's physical. We've all had that experience. The pain of dukkha is much, much deeper. And really much more difficult, but can also be much more subtle. And so we bend our lives to it. To be attentive and alert. The faith mind says one thing, all things, move amidst them and intermingle without distinction. Live in that realization. So to begin, it begins with being aware of all things, of moving amidst, of intermingling, of distinctions. These are the realities we have to bring our attention to. Or rather, as Dogen says, just open your eyes. They're there, everywhere. And so the wound of the mind brings ourselves into attention. And we could also think of this as how you would move in a crowded room with a lot of little children where you have to get across fast, right? Carefully. So that it conveys the sense of how that lack of mindfulness doesn't just cause us pain, it causes other people pain. Shanti Deva says, I can accept losing my wealth and reputation, even my livelihood or my body. I can even accept my other virtues that seem to vanish in various moments, but I cannot allow my practice of guarding the mind to decline. Things come and go, jobs, relationships, intentions, opportunities. We can suffer from this, but we understand that's part of life. We have to accept it, be resilient, move on. But there are certain things that we should not accept, like samsara. Bodhicitta is not accepting samsara as a viable path. It's not accepting that this is all there is. It's not accepting that there is no other way. Samsara, suffering, distraction, self-centeredness, ongoing joylessness, lack of enthusiasm, these are the things that we should not accept. And in not accepting them, in raising bodhicitta, in engaging practice, then And in determining that we will free ourselves, then we have to practice accepting all of it from the place of practice. Before that, to accept it is to die within it. But once we're practicing, now we have to accept all of those. But it's a very different kind of acceptance. It's not defeat or complacency or indifference. It's acceptance so we can liberate ourselves, so we can practice. So Shanti Deva says, first I should check to see how my mind is. If I see it's filled with negativity, I should remain unmoving with a mind as still as deep water. To study the way is to study the self, is to study the mind, is to study a mind filled with negativity. What is unmoving? To remain unmoving. It's not passive, it's not numb, it's not controlled, it's not remote or shut down. It's alert, it's stable, it's mindful, it's aware. There is a practice of holding the mind, of restraining the mind from running off, of holding the object of one's attention in mind, like the breath or a koan, and of doing that with effort, right? And it needs to be skillful, because there is a quality of that in which we are directing our mind, in which we are trying to control the mind's awareness and maintain it. We're trying to maintain a mind that is not distracted. But the skillfulness of that is that it's not just aggressive controlling, that it's not just trying to stop, that it's not fearful of this mind, it's not hateful of this mind, it's not going to war with this mind. It's trying to be the master of this mind. Which means rather than having our distractedness be our master, be our ruler, that we want to, in a very basic way, take our natural place. It's like rather than just going along and just making decisions and reacting to things and doing things on the basis of just whatever's happening around us or whoever has a good idea or what other people think we should do or what other people think we are, that there's a point where we realize we need to reclaim our natural place. And so there is a practice of this. And that's what he means when he talks about the rope of mindfulness. Right? But the rope is not around your neck. And that is so that as we are practicing and learning how to practice that, that rope becomes looser and looser and looser. Right? So there's the Oxfordian picture downstairs where the seeker has the rope, right, and the whip to subdue the ox, the self. And then a little bit later, the seeker is riding the ox, right? They're not enemies. They never were. And yet, because of habitual mental formations, in order to shift that karma, we have to apply some effort, but we have to do it skillfully. And that's not going to be a perfect path. In other words, we will err. That's why there's so many teachings that talk about too taut, relax, too loose, apply more effort. Right? And then it's an ongoing discovery of that exquisite middle path. keeping the mind on the mind, on the moving thoughts and emotions that create the sense of dividedness, right? So that we're not trying to get to a point where we never have any more thoughts, or even where we never have any stray thoughts, but just that those thoughts that arise are not deluded thoughts. We do not become deluded in the presence of those thoughts. Dogen says, Zazen Shin says, do not value what is far away, and don't despise it either. Just become completely familiar with it. Do not despise what is near at hand, and do not value it. Just become intimate with it. Don't take the eyes lightly, and don't give them too much weight. Don't give weight to the ears, and don't take them lightly. Make your eyes and ears clear and sharp. A mind as still as deep water, the natural, original mind. And Zazen is this mind, and it's also the path. Shanti Deva says, I should never look around out of distraction or for no purpose, but always with a resolute mind be mindful of my gaze. And this can seem like, come on. I should always have a resolute mind and be mindful? You mean like in every moment? Yeah. Yeah, in fact, that's our aspiration of how to live the way of a bodhisattva. But he's saying to never look around out of distraction for no purpose, but be mindful. In other words, taking charge or guarding the mind also means guarding the eyes and the ears. And again, this doesn't mean, you know, when we hear this, we can think, okay, that means live in a bubble. Don't ever, you know, have any, you know, crazy friends. Don't do anything a little on the edge. That's not what he's saying. He's not saying be afraid. He's saying just be purposeful. Don't be led by our distractedness, but lead your eyes. Be resolute. When walking, walk. When bowing, bow. When resting, rest. What is the need to look elsewhere? There's no greener grass. And then he says, from time to time, to relax my gaze, I should look around without distraction. And if someone appears in my field of vision, I should acknowledge them and greet them. So he says, don't look around out of distraction or for no purpose, but from time to time, relax your gaze. Look around without distraction. And if you see someone, say hello. Very simple. Lest our resoluteness become tight and rigid, from time to time, relax your gaze. To guard the mind from becoming attached to things, we can become attached to guarding the mind. Lowering our gaze, maintaining silence, so that we can go deeply into this mind of non-distractedness, we can be attached to lowering our gaze and being in silence. To be pliant, malleable. Commitment is in the mind, not in our senses, not in the idea of never looking around. And while we're gaining strength and pliancy and commitment and confidence, in Sesshin, we agree together that we will do this. woman in the Zen warnings at the end of the Women Koan says, to observe the regulations and keep to the rules is like tying oneself without a rope. To act freely and unrestrainedly, just as one wishes, is to do what hungry ghosts and angry gods do. And this is really important for us because we practice in a tradition in which there are things that look like rules and regulations, right? And so to observe them, just for the sake of observing them, to not understand their spirit. Why? What are we doing? So it's coming from within. And so it's not rigid and tight. He said, this is like tying oneself without a rope. But just to say, I'm free of all rules and regulations, is to do what hungry ghosts and angry gods do. In other words, it's just to accept samsara. Liberation is not a task, it's not a chore, it's not an obligation. It's being liberated from living by rules and regulations so that we can move freely within a world and within a sangha and training and a school or an office or a family relationship in which there are rules, there are agreements. We make agreements. How are we going to make this thing work, this thing, wherever we might be? What do we need to do together? What are the parameters? What are the boundaries? Right? That's how we keep the thing holding together, fulfill a purpose. But to do so in a way that is free within. And then he goes on to say, to avoid dangers or accidents on the path, I should occasionally look in all directions and prevent my mind from being distracted by relying upon conscientiousness, being conscientious. In a sense, we could put all of this together by saying, just be appropriate. Move in accord with time and place. What's happening right now? Gassana Roshi talked about the precepts in terms of the time. What time is it? Time of day? Time of the week, time of the year, time of your life, time of history. What's the place? Where are you? Are you in a zendo? Are you in Times Square? Are you in a club? Are you at home? Position. What is your position to that place, to that situation, to the people, to the person in front of you? To understand that, right? Because all of those create context. All of those have a kind of force that exert upon the action. And then degree. What kind of degree is needed? What kind of degree of mindfulness? What degree of relaxation? What degree of tautness? Where do I put my gaze? You know, every once in a while a resident will say, you know, when they're coming down the hill in the morning for morning zazen, and it's dark, should they keep their attention in their feet or can they take in the night sky and the shrouded mountain? And I say, it depends on where you want to put your attention. Right? One is not more than the other, but just be aware of what you're doing. In other words, wherever you put your attention there. Be purposeful. Be mindful. And this being purposeful, again, is not like, you know, with a clipboard. It's just wanting to be awake. It's wanting to be awake and recognizing that when we're not, that's painful. It's actually painful. If we pay attention, we'll see that. And that when we're mindful, when we're awake, when the mind is becoming unified, that is pleasing. in all kinds of ways and in all kinds of directions. He says, I should undertake what I intend and have decided to do without being distracted by other things. And with my thoughts focused on that practice for now, I should just do that. Again, so in our training, we're mind training to do exactly this, and body training. And so we try and make that a little bit easier. So every thing we are going to do, we signal with an instrument. This is what we're going to do right now. We're going to do Zazen. This is what we're going to do right now. We're going to do Kenyan. This is what we're going to do right now. The purpose being that with each of those signals, that I undertake what I intend and have decided to do. Practicing the way in this moment means this, focusing on this practice, and I should do just that. That's what I have decided to do. We can practice as though just being here is expressing that. It's not. I mean, it's expressing it in a sort of a general way, that implicit in our being here is wanting to do that. But that's not enough. It's too distant. It's too vague. It's already been forgotten. Right? It's as though the power is in just being here, or the power is in the fact that we're doing Kenyan. I don't actually have to do it. I just sort of have to be in the vicinity where it's happening. Or I have to be with some other people who are doing it. It'll rub off. I mean, yeah. We know that's not true, and yet we can practice that way. And so what he's really talking about, and we spent a lot of the weekend on the Bodhisattva Path retreat talking about this, about the importance of intention. That moves mountains. That creates karma. That has consequence. When we don't have intention, when we don't intend and decide to do this, what we will almost certainly do is whatever is the strongest, whatever shouting the loudest, right? Whatever voice, whatever mouth has been fed the most, that's what we're going to do right then. And until that seat of meditation, that seat of mindfulness, of just this, really becomes grounded and integrated, so that that intention has become integrated and digested, functioning moment to moment, right? No longer just, you know, stop and start, off and on, but more seamless. Until that really begins to happen, we need to continue to bring intention. Commitment. And all of this is really in the service of what Dogen spoke of as the Dharma gate of ease and joy. That discipline within the Buddhist tradition sometimes seems austere, right? Because we're in the field of desires, right? We're in the feeding ground of desires, of all of those mouths that want to be fed. And to say no when we've said yes so many times, somebody's going to be crying. There's going to be some screaming going on. But that's so that fragile, transient, superficial pleasure, which comes and goes, can find its true ease and joy. Because after all, from the beginning to the end, it's just that. A mind awake within the way is a joyful mind. And that joyfulness has many, many manifestations that we discover. We discover what ease, what Dogen means when he says ease. We discover what joy is. We discover what serenity is, what mindfulness is, what patience is. And so let's really take Shantideva's words to heart, that as we move through each day, this is, you know, Sesshin is a training unto itself, and it's also life. We're just living together this week, right? We're waking up, we're sitting, we're having meals, we're cleaning up the dishes, we're working a bit, we're living. And so to really see it as helping us to understand, how do we do that within the way? How do we do that as an unbroken stream of joyfulness? And how does that joyfulness manifest when it's difficult, right? When you're tired, when you're weary, when you're irritated, when that wound of the mind is pressing upon us. Well, the Buddha said, don't deny it and don't indulge it. And if you don't engage in those two extremes, you will find the path, because that is the path. You are in it in that moment. And you will experience that joy in the midst of that struggle. And we will be surprised that joy manifests in that way at that moment. Different than what we thought.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.